All right, everyone all set? Do I get started? Okay, this is the final review session, voluntary review session for the statutory interpretation class. Just everyone, since it's voluntary, clearly, you know, the agenda is mostly up to you. I'm just going to start with just talk about a few quick things, talk about the process up to the final, talk a little bit about the final itself, hopefully no surprises at this point in the semester, walk through the sample final exam that I posted to the website earlier this semester, and give you an idea of what sorts of things I was looking for, and then wrap up just with open the floor for any and all questions. Hopefully that works for y'all. If you need to leave earlier, that's fine. If you want to just pull me aside at some point later, just let me know, we can try and schedule something. So let me start with first a couple of announcements. I first want to say my apologies to some extent. I plan to do this session in a Hawaiian shirt and shorts, but I'm wearing a suit for, unfortunately, a bit of a sad reason, and I just wanted to sort of let you know because it's a bit of a life reason, life lesson behind it. I just found out that a casual friend, who was a partner over at Winstead, passed away very unexpectedly. He is younger than me. He was a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps who left the force, joined the reserves, but then went to law school and had been practicing environmental law at a very high level here in town. Totally unexpected, complete shock, just a sudden cardiac arrest. So I'm actually going to the funeral this afternoon. That's why I'm dressed, so maybe a little bit more somber than usual, but it's not because of you guys, I promise. I will say, kind of makes you stop and pause. He's younger than me. So all I'll say is, if you want to talk about life in general, I'm very philosophical right now. I'll just say, don't bottle. I mean, you never know. Just grab what you can and do what you can. I'm a terrible fritterer, and this is sort of making me pause and reevaluate some things. Also, a small apology as well. I'm also very short in sleep. I had a neighbor go to the hospital in an emergency ambulance call last night after midnight, and I was there helping them out. So between the two, you're getting me hopefully in a semi-vegetative state, but still functional. So with that, anyone have any announcements or questions in general before I start diving into the agenda for today? By the way, I'm recording all this, so if you miss something or if you need to come back to it later, we can do that. Number one, I just want to talk a bit about the process. Hopefully this is all familiar to you, and all of it is on the website. Today we're just going to have a review session. It's probably going to go to about 10:15. Then after that, I'm open all this week, and unless my trip to Montreal materializes, I'm still on hold for that, all of next week as much as possible. Just call me and email me to reserve a time, because I'm here, but I think they'll get out of the office and they miss me. Drop in. I'm glad to talk with you and answer any questions. In addition, I'm also happy to answer emails, but here's where the process kicks in. Pursuant to the protracted and hard-fought negotiations we did in class, we have a deadline. Our finalists May 8th. The deadline for your email questions is May 6th, but it's at 10 p.m., so we'll give you a chance to finish your other finalists that day and then kick your questions to me. That gives me the time to pull together a global answer for everybody, which I will distribute by email to everyone and post to the website. I will try and get up as fast as I can, hopefully the next morning, and make a little bit more time for me on the questions I get. I may not answer everyone's question because I may consolidate. I may also answer smaller scale questions that maybe aren't as helpful the rest of the class directly to you. All I do ask is that if you have a question that you don't want the rest of the class to share in, that's fine. Just let me know, and I'll make sure that I don't include the global response. With that, finals on the 8th, the room puts posted. Any questions about the processing up to the final before I start talking about the final? Everyone's totally cool with that? All right. By the way, I really, really mean this. You guys are getting much more exposure to different approaches from all the other classes. If there are other approaches that make more sense to you, let me know. I'd like to make sure this class can be used to agree. The final itself, again, hopefully no surprises. It will be basically three parts equally weighted. The first is short answer. A short answer is 20 questions. and the bulk of them are going to be very familiar to you. Multiple choice format, similar types of materials that we covered in class. If you study the multiple choice questions that we went in our review sessions before each class, you're a good part of the way there. We'll also include some short answers. Now, the short answers, again, let me stress, I know I've said this over and over again, you guys are probably starting to become a meme, but I mean it, short. I can't tell you how distressing it was to watch students totally tube themselves last year by writing 4-page short responses. That's not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for a paragraph, at most two, concise, clear, straight to the point. So that's part one. That should only take you an hour. I'm giving you about maybe 3 minutes for each. Some of them hopefully will go like that, some of them more time. Then the other two parts are each one essay question, each of which will also be weighted equally. And together, all three parts add up to your total score. The other two essay questions, again, you know, I can't talk too much about the content of the essay questions, obviously, but I've had many of you ask in hallways, in my office, in class, I wish Fiozhi was here, what's in the essays? And the short answer is, I can't tell you that, but I can tell you, you know me by now. You've had me now for a long semester, and you know how I approach things. I like to find practical applications that require you to take the principles we've talked about in class and apply them. I like to try and find scenarios where you're going to fall between the cracks and have to be creative on how to deal with them. And I'm looking for you to be concise, thoughtful, to give me a structured answer. I am not looking for kitchen sinks. I will give a higher grade to a shorter essay that shows an understanding of the issue than as opposed to someone who basically throws a checklist up and tries to get every possible term they can into the answer and hopes it gets a check mark. That's not how I grade. So with that, any questions about the final itself in that format? The short answers, I will say, because they are short answers, it's not going to be Scantron. You're going to need to write even your multiple choice answers in your blue books. Hopefully that's not going to cost too much mechanical problem. Okay. Is that a question?
What was the last part of your name?
You're asking me to repeat something already. It's only 9:10. Yeah, it's fine. The short answer is going to be in your blue book. You're not going to have a Scantron. Normally I would have a Scantron because I'd say the majority of them are multiple choice. But since I do ask you to write like a short paragraph answer for a handful of those questions, Scantron won't work.
Okay. Multiple choice questions, are you going to count off points if you did it wrong?
No.
Okay.
Yes, guess, guess, guess. I cannot help you if you leave it blank. If you guess and guess wrong, you're in the same place as if you left it blank, but who knows, the gods may smile on you. All right? Oh, I haven't even considered that. That's really,
I should have been.
All right. I'm sorry, but I have to admit, I was going to start teasing you about perhaps this mild strain of sadism, but I'm not going to do that since another professor's doing that. No, my philosophy is I'd rather for you to give me your best shot rather than hold back because you're worried about getting it wrong. Any other questions? That was an excellent question, by the way. I like it.
What is your feel about case rather than case analysis? Like some of our professors don't really care, and some of them really do care. So all that.
Okay. Fair question. Because this is a weird class, we go over a lot of different cases, and the subject matters are all over the place. As a result, I don't expect you to know all the cases. Some of the cases are frankly pretty minor illustrations of underlying statutory points. There are a handful, though, which I hopefully have emphasized over the semester, are important. God bless you if you walk out here not knowing what Chevron stands for. I can't help you at that point. The same bulk, ilk, we're probably talking about Overton Park. We're probably talking about Heckler v. Cheney. We're probably talking about, Holy Trinity Church. Church of the Holy Trinity. But I'm not going to expect you to know all the cases in the footnotes. So if you cite a case, let me rephrase that. If I ask an essay question and it's clear that one of the major cases is germane, cite the case. I will take off if you miss it. But I will not give extra points if you give me the machine gun listing of every possible case you possibly can. I'll be honest, in practice, you need to know the major cases to be familiar and fluent with them, but look it up if you don't know the minor cases. Good question. Any others?
Is that there are four main cases, or three main cases that you're doing? Shall not be a part of the fourth one, or is that cases?
Those are the big three. Or, of course, standard of judicial review of agencies' interpretations of statutes. I mean, keep in mind it's a fairly circumscribed field. I mean, that doesn't talk about review for judicial review of agency internal procedure. You know, that's the Vermont Yankee, NRDC versus Vermont Yankee, your case. It's not about agency interpretation of their own regulations. That's the Alt case, which we mentioned in class. Which normally I wouldn't shine a light on, except that it's going to be Supreme Court review like in the next year or so. Okay? Any others? Nick, it's so disappointing I can't call on you because you're wearing a hat. I'm violating my class protocol here.
The last day to do it.
That was smart. Actually, I forgot. Okay, so with that, this is your review session. My plan was to go over the practice final. I can also dispense with that if you guys feel like you already have that pretty much in hand. Let the recorder note there was laughter around the room.
I have it.
You have it? You're ready to go? Well, you can just go get another kolache and not worry. Okay. Then let's start. And again, we can modify courses needed. The first one, these are the short answers. By the way, your final exam will not have short answers quite as long as these. These are meant to illustrate the kind of narrative ones I wanted answers written out for. Remember again, a lot of yours, both of yours would be multiple choice, which you're all very familiar with from our review questions. But the short answer on this one was, on March 31st, 2013, the state of Texas legislature enacted the following statute, and this is a statute that basically made it a felony to get Adderall and other ADHD medication and then distribute it to others. The statute was designed so that we have liability whether or not the violator sold, purchased, or distributed drugs for profit or just for personal use, i.e. handing it out to friends. Liability for violations are in addition to and cumulative of any penalties under federal drug control laws and regulations. So, as a result, of course, the state police have arrested your client. And usually get this call in the middle of the night, usually on a weekend. She amassed a large stockpile of Adderall by taking only half the prescribed dosage over a long period of time. Zach, if you want, there's some kolaches up here in front. Grab some of your life. And then she saved the remainder for 2 years. By the way, I knew kids who did this when my kids were going to high school. She admitted that she intended to use the stockpiles in her final exams that year. But the police also suspect she planned to give or sell for a very small amount some of her stockpile to her friends and classmates. Give a short argument why the new state statute should not be construed to impose criminal liability on your client's actions. Again, short answer. I'm looking for like a paragraph, maybe a three sentences identifying the three key principles of statutory interpretation that you would invoke saying why your client is not liable under this statute. Now, I'm worried that I'm going to tax your patience. Just a quick showing of hands, just quick throwing out there. What principles would you guys have thrown an answer for this one? This is not Socratic, but I just want to make sure this question is not too obscure for you.
Rule of lenity.
Rule of lenity, obviously, great one, slammed up. Find two more.
Observed results.
Why observed results?
I was thinking more along the lines of if you had a prescription, mm-hmm. It should be part of it that if you had a prescription and you were liable, you can't observe because it's my personal use, you'd be liable for taking prescription drugs.
Okay, honestly, I might give you a a minus, check minus on that one. You know, kind of in there, but not quite what I was looking for. Because the absurd results doctrine, as we've talked about in class, has been invoked, but it's also a fairly controversial doctrine that tends to be judges try to cabin into cases where truly, obviously, facially is absurd. And here, I think it might be facially arguable that legislature meant to get hold of people who are doing this kind of thing. Any others?
About ordinary meaning of the words.
How so?
Sell, buyer, or sell, purchase, and distribution doesn't include stockpiling. So if you just look at the ordinary meaning of the term sell, purchase, and distribution, stockpiling probably wouldn't be.
Okay. And honestly, I probably would have also given you partial credit on that because what I would have said was expresso unis, and that it doesn't say stockpiling. So by not including that term, it meant not to encompass it. But let's include that. Any others?
Presumption against retroactivity.
Aha, how so?
Because she did all this in the past, and she hasn't done anything since then. She just has it now. She's allowed to have it, so she hasn't done anything wrong. This doesn't say to go back and
For you gamers out there, you found the Easter egg. That is the one that about 10% of the class got last year and was one of the ones I was looking for, but it required you to have a little bit of a finer, close read of the statute and fact situation. The last one I would have looked for, and by the way, very good, would have been constitutional avoidance. Why? And this is a little bit of a reach, but it's unusual to have a criminal statute impose felony liability without regard to intent. And notice the statute specifically says no intent. So I would have also given credit for that. But again, one paragraph with a minimal explanation so that you get right to the heart of the matter. Does that make sense for folks? Any other questions about this first one? Sort of self-answer, Allegra?
You said constitutional avoidance.
No, that's the question is in part, if you take a look at section F of this model statute language. So shall attach regard without regard to whether it was violated or sold with the intent to profit. And you could argue that effectively is like a strict liability statute. If you just possess it, you're liable. There's no mens rea required.
So just talking about the exam, taking the approach that you mentioned to these questions, and I know you said these were a little bit longer, but on a question like this, you would want us to talk about every different tool we can think of, right?
Well, I would not, like again, kitchen sink, you might get yourself some diminishing returns issues. If you spend 30 minutes listing every possible thing you can that would apply here, you're going to kill yourself in the rest of the short answers.
Okay.
I'm looking for 3 or 4. That's about it.
Is there any way we would know that we had to do 3? Like, how do we know to do 3, 4? I mean, this question, how would we know when we completely answer it?
Generally, I try to structure the question so there's only a handful of short answers that could potentially be relevant. I mean, if you find yourself invoking, the last antecedent rule, there's not clearly an example of how it would apply here, you know you're starting it off. Generally, I'm looking for something you can legitimately answer in a couple of minutes. All right. Is that everyone getting more calibrated here? Okay. Number 2. Plural marriage. I'll offer this up as a minor thought, and this is just to think about for all your professors in terms of test taking strategy. As a professor, I will say most of them love to teach. They love being in the classroom. They love writing and research. The one thing that's at the bottom of everyone's list is grading exams. So you will notice, I suspect, a trend that professors tend to write exams about things that are interesting to them because it makes it a lot more interesting for them to grade the answers to the exam. So just small point, if you know your professor has a strong subject matter interest or has talked about a particular event that seems to really pique his or her interest, don't be surprised if it pops up as part of a factual scenario in the final exam. I don't know if you guys have experienced that yet. Yes? No? Okay.
You seem to like the environment, so.
I'm trying really hard not to, because I know it. However, having said that, I meditate Zen quite a bit. That's the nature of the class. All right, so plural marriages. Here, the state of Oklatopia, there you go, has a co-construction statute identical in all relevant respects to the Texas Co-Construction Act. It's a state in the United States, or subject to federal laws, and it passed a statute in 2013 that recognized same-sex marriages. It provides that marriages between partners of the same sex shall enjoy the same privileges and protections to the full extent that state and federal laws accord to marriages between partners of the opposite sex. Section 2 of the statute provides that any conflict with federal law or laws of other jurisdictions will lead the court to interpret the law to preserve the protection of same-sex marriages to the full extent possible. In other words, almost effectively a severability clause. And the effective date of the statute is September 1st, 2013. Well, as you might expect, a straightforward marriage equity act has resulted in a challenge by a public advocacy group claiming that this statute now implicitly endorses plural marriages. One of the criticisms of plural marriages is that if you have more than one partner, by definition, you're going to include potentially some partners in that marriage who are of the same sex, and that if that's prohibited by state law, plural marriages are also prohibited. By removing that bar, you can now have more than two people in a marriage. So the question is, will the new Oklatopia statute protect existing and future plural marriages in this state? Focus only on statutory construction, this is not Professor Turner's final, not con law issues. So with that, again, this is such a rich, meaty question, you could write literally a book on it. But I'm asking you to come up with a paragraph of what you think are the best handful of key statutory arguments, one way or another. By the way, you'll also find I tend not to have a right or wrong answer that I expect you to give. I expect you to give me your answer. I'm looking for your rationalization, your justification for it. So if you say, here, it won't protect, I'll accept that. You give me good reasons. You say it will, also I'll accept that. Give me good reasons. So with that, this one's a little bit squishier than the other one. What arguments, what statutory canons and principles would you apply here to say one way or the other?
I guess, I don't know, Dictionary Act or just clear meaning of the word partner, I went and looked up what partner meant. Mm-hmm. And in relation to marriage, the definitions specified just like that you were sharing a habitation with one other person. It kept saying a person that you're married to, a individual. So I took that to mean that they would mean single individual here as well.
Okay. I would say plain meaning has a place here. The Dictionary Act arguably might have some meaning here as well. The federal statute sets out terms and definitions. The question in my mind would be the dates of those dictionaries. I mean, if they predated the evolution of same-sex marriage, they'll probably have a lot of dictionaries that say marriage is a marriage between a man and a woman.
Yeah, I'm just on dictionary.com, it just said a person.
I'm pretty sure most courts would reject dictionary.com, but fair enough. But I was thinking Black's Law Dictionary might give you the same definition. All right. Anything else?
I have a question first.
Of course.
So Terry's dictionary, are we expected to prevent dictionary, or are you going to give us?
I am not going to provide a dictionary because typically.
Not give us a dictionary, but give us
I will give you the definitions in the text typically if it's relevant.
Okay.
Or I'll simply say, assume the common meaning of the word, that usually that's a film. Yeah. You can fill the content with what you think you need to. I've had dictionaries before because we have LLM students sometimes in classes, and if English is a second language, I want to make sure they have an equal footing. But I found a lot of students spend a lot of time reading through the pages, and it's a time waster. Okay?
Okay,
now,
answer.
Now.
I said express the other sense because if they admit to include full marriages, then they, I said express the opinion because including one thing is of another, so had they meant to include plural marriages in this statute, they would have mentioned it.
If it's so important, they wouldn't do it by implications. That's almost a FDA versus Brown and Williams tobacco company argument.
No.
Another one to know by name. All right. Any others? Now, if you're looking, Alexa.
Sorry, I have a question.
Of course.
Do we have to reference case names and like stuff like this, like short answers?
Case notes.
Names.
Names.
Names, like cases, like you just said, oh, that sounds like an FDA argument.
Well, like I said, for a handful of cases that stand for important propositions. Yeah, another what case name that might pop up in the answer to this one would be Bob Jones University versus the United States. And you may recall that's the one that, sorry. No, okay, I thought you were going to tell me what the case stood for. I was going to say, all right. But yeah, I will go on marshally ahead. It's a review session. I don't mean to torture you Socratically for the next 30 minutes. Remember, that's the case where you had an overtly racist university that was a 501c3 claiming tax-exempt status. And by the way, there's no, I'm not making an accusation or a value statement. They would not admit other races into the school because of religious beliefs. And the Supreme Court in that case looked to the evolution and change of social circumstance surrounding the statute to find that you had to interpret the same statutory language that had previously been interpreted to allow them tax-exempt status, even though they were overtly racist, to instead say that since the federal government had now adopted a conscious, strong policy against this type of racial discrimination, because the term in the statute was a common law term with deep historical roots that was meant to be flexible and evolving, because the statute was old, it had, as a result, created a situation where the court could fill in meaning that had evolved over time since its passage, as opposed to a new statute where Congress presumably knew what the current meanings were. That allowed the Supreme Court to say that the IRS was correct in interpreting its tax-exempt regulations to say that Bob Jones University could not be tax-exempt anymore. That dynamic interpretation principle could arguably apply here. That the evolution of the concept of marriage might now be not only extended to include same-sex marriages, but arguably maybe plural marriages. I'll tell you though, I would read that argument with a skeptical eye because the consensus on plural marriage is obviously nowhere near as strong or uniform as the evolving consensus on same-sex marriages, which even that is still subject to the fierce debate. Any others?
So what about federalism?
I promise I'll come back to you. Michael?
Federalism, your statement rule, because doesn't the federal government have a ban against plural marriages? So, and you say that Congress has spoken.
Well, I guess would Section 2 pose a problem for you in the statute? It expressly says if there are any conflicts between federal and state law, that you would enforce a statute to the extent you still can outside the conflict. So to a certain extent, that's a clear statement in terms of federalism issues. The other thing about the federalism clear statement principle is that it's top down. The federal government has to be sensitive to the extent it preempts state statutes. This is a state statute, and they're trying to figure out how to harmonize with federal law. So I'm not sure if you could say the clear federalism clear statement principle works up as well. But I would have said thoughtful and given you a check on that, which is probably what you cared about. Sorry.
Yeah, could we use the hard material to kind of inference that the family code of the state probably prohibits, you know, polygamous marriages? And as a result, there's kind of a assumption against, you know, repelled by implication unless it's explicitly named.
I would accept that as long as you expressly stipulate in your answer that, assuming other provisions of the state's family code expressly address polygamous marriages, the entire material would allow us to infer that this new statute does not somehow implicitly enforce them.
So is it a good idea to generally avoid kind of bringing those assumptions in, or can they be useful?
They can be useful.
Okay.
And oftentimes I'll tell you in questions, name, identify facts you need to provide a full answer. Sometimes I'll only give you a partial picture, but I try to flag that.
So you want us to come down and either it will or it won't. You don't want us to analyze both sides of it and say, you know, it depends on the budget.
You can, but I'll be honest with you. you will, I suspect, find yourself spending 20 or 30 minutes providing an analytical answer.
Well, okay, so let's say that...
You could also say, I don't know. I could see arguments on both sides, but then I expect you to give me the arguments.
Okay, well, yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, that's fine. Because I was just going to say, like, if I thought of tiny meaning and expressio unis, and then I also thought of this Bob Jones argument, I could do both.
Fair enough. And I would give you credit for those. If we were talking in my office, I might tease you a bit for not needing to come to a conclusion, but I also understand with a tough issue, you might need to point out the arguments on both sides. Other ones I might have been looking for, constitutional avoidance. You know, in light of case law that's held that federal statutes that restricted recognition of same-sex marriages identify the vulnerable constitutional principle. If you have ambiguities in this statute that lead to one interpretation that might arguably be unconstitutional, constitutional avoidance might allow you to give a preference to the other interpretation. The other one's a bit more of a sneaky one. And again, this is sort of like the one that 10% of the class got last time. Notice the date of the statute. Notice the effective date of the statute. And notice that the question asks, will the statute protect existing and future plural marriages? Does retroactivity play a role? If someone claims to have already been in a plural marriage arrangement, does this statute reach back in time to protect those existing? And here the presumption against retroactivity, again, as long as you identify the principle, I'd be willing to accept whichever way you felt you were cut on this. Okay. But again, one paragraph, three or four sentences. I'm hoping that this is something you can concisely answer. All right, question number three is the fish in the barrel question. Do we even need to talk about the Chevron multiple choice? All right, I mean, put it this way. In the seminal case of Chevron, the Supreme Court held, how many of you said A, B, C, D, three hands up, E, all of the above, two hands up. Okay, the answer is D, B, and C. Remember, A is a definition, it's a question dealing with climate change case law. It's a case I talked about where whether EPA could use the absurd results doctrine to regulate large stationary sources of greenhouse gases. You know, the Clean Air Act doesn't give that express authority. That was 30 years after Chevron, which is under conventional air pollutants, smog. So B and C are the only answers to that one. Okay. And for all the others, if you didn't raise your hand, I assume you're still thinking very deeply about it, right? Any questions about that? I guess for those of you who actually showed up here, I will give you a freebie. I guarantee you there will be a Chevron question on the final. I'm sure you guys are shocked to hear that. Okay.
No,
that's the risk of wearing a hat.
I was just scratching my head.
Okay. All right. So anything else in the short answers before we go to the essay? All clear? Everyone's groovy. All right. Last question is the Safe Urban Agriculture Act. Yes.
Sorry, back to you. Agriculture. Short answers.
Yeah.
Will they all kind of be in the same vein as like these were, where if it's just a statute, we have to apply like statutory interpretation rules to it?
I assume you're not asking me what's on the file.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I guess that's
I will simply say this is a weird class, and it's a class that really is too many classes stitched together in the middle. So I would be a really bad professor if I gave you questions only the first half on maximum statutory interpretation, but not talk about the second half, which is about regulatory practice and how agencies work. So I think I'm not giving away any spoilers here by saying expect some short answer multiple choice on the regulatory part of the class. Is that what you were asking then?
Yeah.
Okay. The reason these short answers are focused on statutory is because that's why I posted it to the website. We hadn't yet gotten to the regulatory portion yet. All right. So hopefully, do I need to read the essay question in general? I mean, this is the one where a statute gets passed because people are starting to keep their own animals in their backyards. And I will tell you, this is a big deal in my neighborhood. People were starting to buy their own chickens. Everyone's up in arms about the noise and smell and risk. So we have a statute that's passed, which effectively is the Safe Urban Agriculture Act, and essentially says that it's designed to make sure that agriculture, urban agriculture, is done safely to avoid unreasonable endangerments or damages to other persons in close proximity. And that urban agriculture is the practice of growing, cultivating, and collecting crops and animal products. So according to the purpose statement. An idea that basically empowers the Department of Agriculture to come up with rules to define what a level of unreasonable risk or damage might be, and it imposes penalties, $25,000 per day, per violation. By the way, practice like that language at the very end is very common. It's not per day, it's per day per violation. So if you have multiple violations on the same day, they all stack. And if they continue for 2 days, they stack again. If they continue for 30 days, you get amazingly quickly multi-million dollar penalties. The agencies are not shy about stacking those penalties when they bring enforcement action because it's a fact that's starting point for negotiations. Not for your final one. Sorry, I just couldn't resist throwing that in. So that's to deal with people keeping chicken coops and pig pens in their backyard, people who are growing their own crops in their backyards. Now you're approached by a client who wants to do something else. She wants to put a green roof on a factory, much larger facility. Green roof is really not designed to yield crops or to raise animals. It's designed to cool the building. It's designed to provide an eco-friendly alternative to trans-standard building technologies and materials. Now, as part of that, the grass and cover that puts up there does generate, incidentally, some fruit. Some of it is edible. And to avoid having to mow it, they talk about putting a couple of goats up there. Not because they're planning to make a cabrito or a hen anytime soon. Does the act apply? Is your client looking at $25,000 per day, per goat, per fruit? Or does this act not apply? What's your argument? What's your best argument? Is that clear for folks? Any questions about the question? Sorry? Say it.
So on section 1005, it says regulations promulgated under section 1004.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that work with, can you be penalized for violating 1003? Because it's not mentioned in that section. And the regulations are under 1004.
Is it self-implemented?
Yeah, that's, I don't know.
I'm only smiling because one of the cases we did not get to this semester talks about that exact issue. I would not expect you to answer that question.
Okay.
I would simply, if you flagged it, I would say, good answer, and give you a little extra boost on the grade points for that one. But you're right, there is a clear link between 1004. It doesn't talk about 1003, and arguably 1003 may be directly enforceable, which may be an issue of liability for your client. What happens if she puts up her roof? Part of Act hasn't promulgated regulations yet, is she still potentially liable? Okay. If I could offer some thoughts about structure before we start talking about how to fill the structure. Notice that this question is designed expressly to capture both halves of the class. You've got a statute, you have a statutory language in front of you, and I'm assuming you guys would glom onto the likely implications, but I'm expecting you to use your tools of statutory interpretation to parse the meaning of that statute. In addition, though, there's a reference to the Department of Agriculture and a delegation of authority to that department. So I'm assuming you'll also think about the fact, the second half of the class, on how agencies implement statutory demands and interpret the terms of those demands would also be relevant. So one way to think about your answer is, what does the statute say? And based on your answer in the statute, what will happen with the agency that your client needs to be thinking about? Because notice the question is, what advice do you give your client to minimize reliability? Does that help? So structure helps a lot. It makes your professor a much happier person at 5 a.m. in the morning on the third cup of coffee. If I can understand your meaning, it will help me give you a better grade.
prefers to go through the interpretation first and then get to agency regulation, or as long as
I'm going to give you a really frustrating answer. I can't give you one size fits all on that one. Sometimes the question may make it clear that the regulation is first and then you get to the statute. I think you look to the question to see which one's logically the predicate for the other. Does that help?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So with that in mind, any other questions or thoughts? One other thing, I should have mentioned this before, extremely important, they can save your bacon. My rule is I can't help you if you leave me a blank page. Going back to your question, if you don't guess on a multiple choice, there's nothing I can do for you. Take a shot, I'm not going to penalize you. On essays, if you run out of time, I will give credit if you give me a concise, clear outline of what you would have written if the clock hadn't run on. It may not be as much as I would have given you for a full answer, but if you leave it blank, I guarantee you I just have to throw a shovel full of dirt in the grave. It's not all I can do for you. So please, I know you probably hear this from your other professors, save some time at least for them, you know, to give me at least the meat of your answer, even if you can't fully flesh it out. Okay. So with that in mind, let's talk about the two levels of the answer. Statutory interpretation. Do y'all want me to sort of walk through the things I was looking for, or do you want to take a stab at it? Fill in the answer yourself. I'm happy to either way, whichever works best for you. Because I feel like I'm talking into a submission. What?
What you're looking for.
That's not an answer. I apologize for teasing you. It was unmerited. All right. In other words, she says, cut to the chase. All right. Level one is statutory interpretation. You can tell from the way I read the question, hopefully it left out the pages you read the question yourselves, we've got a bit of a mismatch here. We've got the image in the statute of your bucolic chicken coop in the backyard side by side with the monster multi-acre factory with a green roof. So the question I would expect you to be pulling your tools of statutory interpretation to is a green roof agriculture or urban agriculture as contemplated by the Act? So what tools seem to be the most appropriate there? Notice there is no definition of agriculture in the statute. At least the portions we have. So therefore, you could say, you know, going back to some of your earlier answers here, it's fair to go to the plain or ordinary meaning of the term. And if you're representing your client, obviously the plain meaning of agriculture typically contemplates the husbandry of plants and animals to generate a consumable product. The purpose of the statute says that if it doesn't define agriculture. So, step one, plain meaning, agriculture does not contemplate a green roof because you're not trying to create consumable foodstuffs. Second, you know, the title might be getting a little extra support, like saying urban agriculture. Again, another way to drive a wedge between the green roof as opposed to a standard food production agriculture. But if you were to point to the title, I'd also expect you to say the title only provides some way, but the title alone is typically not given overriding effect by the courts. It's an addition of additional meaning. I'd expect you to point to the purpose of the statute. And you are allowed to look at the overall structure of the statute and, as we talked about in class, fill in the meaning of terms based on the overall structure of the statute and its purpose. And here, the fact that it's growing, cultivating, and collecting, as well as crops and animal products as defined by the purpose, gives you additional indicia to how to interpret the term. Notice as well, and here's the point that Terry raised earlier, 1004 and 1005 do not include the reference to 1003. In other words, is the ban self-implementing? Or do you have to wait until the Farm Agriculture passes the rules? If you're advising your client, you know that Congress made an express decision only to have liability attached after the Farm Agriculture defined what an unreasonable risk is. Until it does so, there's not liability that we argue for your client. The last is, I might expect you to flag a bit of the trap. You might see people say, the rule of lenity applies. That's the penalties here. And the short answer is, hopefully everyone knows this by heart. We can almost say it together like a Broadway production. It only applies in criminal cases. This is not identified as a criminal penalty. It's not identified as a misdemeanor. It's not identified as a felony. It's simply a penalty, a civil penalty. Rule of lenity does not apply. Could, if you're feeling creative, make the argument that civil penalties, that get large enough, could be classified as punitive. But I'll tell you, when you're making that argument, it's a half-court shot. I'm not expecting you to make that argument this answer, unless you really want to. What I'm really trying to say is that the rule of lenity typically is not going to help here, because this is defined by this legislature as a civil statute.
Could you use absurd results? Sounds like a great word for, like, you know, provide all these benefits to the community, the statute.
Sure, absolutely. As long as you flag that absurd results typically is reserved for scenarios where the results are truly and facially absurd. Yeah. That a legislature could not reasonably contemplate that a green roof constituted agriculture of any sort.
Or, well, I was just going to say that it would be absurd that a legislature would, like, you know, prohibit something that would be environmentally beneficial and lower energy.
Absolutely. And if you put that in, I would give you credit for that. I just told you that you would also temper it a little bit by saying that this is absurd results doctrine is maybe used with a little caution, because of course, tend to say that for a special situation.
Okay.
You touched on the rule of lenity and how it doesn't apply. Would it be worthwhile to state, I guess, issues that don't apply? You see what I'm getting at? Like, should we waste? I don't want to say waste.
No, waste is a fair point.
Would it be a waste of time?
Because I do not want you to be, like I said earlier at the start of our session, I don't want you to be chasing ghosts with these. Only if it's an issue which looks like it would inevitably or likely pop up in the answer. And here, rule of lenity seems, I'll be honest with you, it's kind of on the borderline. It's fair because the point is so large. But at the same time, I want to make sure people realize that if you point to rule of lenity, you have to say it's usually just for the criminal concept. All right? Any others?
The way I've been thinking about this question was that even if we could try and argue that, like, should we get to a point where, like, we essentially, because it asks for legal advice, so partly should we also advise them what happens if we can't get them out of this law? Like, is all the stuff we've talked about so far saying why it doesn't apply? If it does apply, should we then give them legal advice about, like, what to do if they're, if it's applying to them?
I love a great transition, thank you. Because remember, it's a two-part answer. The second part is the regulatory practice part. So let's assume, you know, we grab for the brass ring and we miss. And we could say to the client, statute arguably doesn't apply. And if you really want to roll the dice, we could just put in the green roof and say, we are outside the statute, and if they bring enforcement action against us, file those grounds. But if you want to also minimize liability, you can take advantage of the regulatory process. And here, the statute clearly identifies the Department of Agriculture as the prime mover for regulation to implement this statute. It charges this department with express obligation to define what an unreasonable risk of water flow is. So at this point, in your second part of your answer, I hope at this point you're able to say, clearly then, delegation of authority under Chevron. And that any rules of that the legislature came up with would almost automatically be guaranteed Chevron step two, especially if there are notice and comment regulations that would pass the meeting test.
And should we assume that they are?
It hasn't happened yet. So that's the problem. That's where the advice comes in. So that means, that translates into, if you can get the agency to pass a rule that favors your client, that rule will likely receive a very deferential review by the judiciary. Make sense so far? And I feel like we've done this so much, I'm worried I'm stating the obvious, and you guys are thinking, get to the point. So seriously, any questions?
So the actual advice is, go on to the notice of comment thing and suggest that they define crops.
That's how it's going to conclude here. participate actively, that's a problem. Create a record. Make sure that your notice, your comments evoke a response from the agency. And then, if the agency disagrees, you also have a position at that point in the record to challenge it, even if you have a standard review that might not be in your favor. But if you don't raise the issues, it's not in the record, you are approved. You really do need to raise it. Now, before I move on, there's also a little bit of, a Barry Easter egg in this one, so I want to make sure folks are clear on sort of the mainline answer. Well, clearly, any questions about this so far in the Chevron framework and how it translates into action and advice to your client? The Easter egg is, can you go to the Department of Agriculture now? Can you talk with them one-on-one? Or is that ex parte communication? Now, I'm not expecting you to know the home box office versus FCC decision by name. I'll be honest with you, that's a DC Circuit decision. It's not that often cited, it's not that important, but it was one of the ones we finished up the class with. That's the case that said you aren't allowed to have ex parte communications with the agency when they're doing a pending agency action that allocates a valuable resource. And if that ex parte communication takes place, it's got to get to the record as soon as possible afterwards. That's not our situation here, though, is it? And at least you could say it does not appear that the agency has begun the notice and comment rulemaking. Or you could say, assuming the agency has not begun notice and comment rulemaking, you are free to go talk to the decision makers at the agency now. One thing that the decision did say that your notice to book mentioned is that prior to the initiation of that agency process, there is no ex parte ban. So you can sit down and have a cup of coffee with the people who maybe a year from now will be making the decision on your provision, on your case. But until that agency process kicks in, there's no ex parte ban. Bless you. That's land yet. I'll be honest with you. That's the sort of thing where you get a sort of little extra bonus. I'm not expecting everyone to catch that one, but I just wanted to flag it for you. That's a sort of, I think, a bit fair amount. Then throw it to your answer. Now, was that what you were thinking?
I know, but can you state the holding HBO again? Is it not allowed to have ex parte communication with the agency after the regulatory process is begun?
Yes, it's a regulatory process that allocates a scarce good or a benefit directly that you're involved in. In other words, if you're deciding on the allocation of radio frequency spectrum that's worth millions of dollars, it's not appropriate to have ex parte communications. If you're making a decision on a permit, you know, a large permit for building a facility, no ex parte communications.
So just if it's like directly involved, if it's tangentially related and it hasn't,
you're pushing it. Most, I'll tell you, most Texas agencies just don't talk. And I think the only other advice that I might suggest you might want to include in your answer is the practical one. Get rid of the goats. Don't harvest the fruit. Don't plant anything that's edible. If it's just grass, you're clearly farther away from any conceivable definition of urban agriculture. The reason they're getting in trouble here is because they decide to mow the grass biologically. And because they plant some things that just incidentally happen to have fruit on them. If you get the same green roof without those risks, your client's risk is lower.
I was wondering about stuff like allergy-inducing plants and stuff like that, because it says endangers people nearby a property. So I was wondering, like, should they hire like professional gardeners to deal with this? So like, make sure they don't get plants that cause people allergies. And I don't know how and like how specific and dangerous this means.
I'm always thought it's very creative. I like that. You know, the idea that you'd have actually a ragweed regulation, given the way we're all sneezing right now, it sounds like a great idea. Having said that, it's not something I've been looking for you to include in your answer. You've got everything else that was important added at the end, that'd be fine. But that's kind of getting a little bit outside the zone of my expected interest here.
Okay, yeah, because it just seemed like viability really only attached, and you only got trouble if you endanger people or property. And I'm assuming factories are really near other people's property, like super close. So it would mostly be people like employees and stuff like that.
And last year, and by the way, all these questions from us, it's my mess, so this is real stuff. Last year I had some people say that you should buy a green belt from the factory. violate properties. If there's no one living near you, you're less likely to go right in the rules. And I think your guardrail is also the same category, a creative way to keep reducing the risk in the real world. But again, that's sort of like the last line if you've got a legal engine, so I really care about it.
Can you talk about the may versus shall argument? Because I know it's a shall statute, you really didn't touch on that, and how that can be sure is being permissive.
Which one are we talking about here? Section 103? 1005?
And also, I guess, specifically 1005.
Okay. In 1005, shall is typically the statutory default language. It's not meant to be a command that you have to pay a penalty. It's within the agency's discretion, or the government's discretion, how much of a penalty they want to see. But the language is typically said, you may pay a penalty, implies that a penalty is not in any way a legal consequence of your action. Most statutes will say, shall pay a penalty. I'm not sure if there's much way to put in the may versus shall there. Where I had may versus shall was in the other section 1003, in terms of whether it was self-implemented. By saying shall, you imply that it's already got a legal effect. It says may, arguably it's not self. That's the only thing. Does that get to your question? Okay. All right, so that's the bulk of what I had for the answers. And glad if you had other ideas or things you wanted to throw in there, I'm glad to get them around with you now.
Are there any regulations like this?
Actually, not. There's no statute. There have been ordinances that have been discussed. The city of Bel Air is actually talking about an ordinance, but it's focused more on nuisances like roosters crowing in the morning. But the idea that wild pigs will be running the streets has not really been on anyone's radar yet. But it is an evolving issue, especially with farmers markets now being more popular. Anything else?
In terms of writing our answers, do you like full essays, or can we do outline format?
I prefer full answers. Frankly, it makes it easier for me to grade. If you do an outline, sometimes you sell yourself short because it's hard to convey the complexity of an issue. I only would suggest an outline. The Master of the Red Death, the midnight clock is striking, your time is running out. My God, then you start off. I have seen good answers that were outlines, but effectively they could have been full written because the outlines are very detailed. It's just the way that person thought. Yeah. It's a rare case that I would prefer to try. Any others? Because with that, it's sort of open season on any other questions you guys had outside of the sample finals or just the rest of the class. And they're off. Unconstitutionality canon, first of all, is different from the constitutional avoidance principle. So keep that distinction clear in mind. The unconstitutionality canon is the hard, strong version, but it's narrow. It requires the court, first of all, defining ambiguity in the statute. If you don't have an ambiguity, let it apply, you're out. Second, the court has to assess the constitutionality of those two alternative interpretations. And here's where the barrier is, the threshold is high, it has to find one of them as unconstitutional. And if it finds that, the it's very strong saying the court must choose the other interpretation. Constitutional avoidance doctrine allows you to say that there is a grave concern about the constitutionality without actually finding it to be unconstitutional. It's a softer version. So courts tend to invoke it more often. Does that sort of get to the gist? Theories are relevant and worth mentioning when the question puts them into play. It will be a rare circumstance where the difference between intentionalism and purposivism and dynamic interpretation schools of thought are going to give you different answers that are legally relevant. If I give you a multiple choice, as you just mentioned, obviously then. But quite honestly, think, is there a factual scenario that comes to your mind that I can ask you to advise a client where which school of thought you decide to adhere to is going to be legally relevant and what advice you get to the client? I'm not trying to disparage what we read in class. It helps give you a framework for these theories, but they're not really.
Well, I guess Laura, you have this question too on the sample, where maybe the intentionality or the purpose of the legislature was not to condone plural marriages, it was specifically for the purpose of gay marriages, so I don't think we can make that.
So, purposivism might be relevant in that circumstance. You could also recount in terms of saying that, you know, the legislative intent behind the statute is evident in the structure and plain language of the statute. So, that's why I also talked about Bob Jones. That's a legal way of importing some of the dynamic interpretation doctrine we talked about.
Okay, so for the unconstitutionality canon and the constitutional avoidance canon, if there's a federal law as opposed to a constitutional issue that prohibits it, is that the same as the constitutional issue? Or is that the federal jurisdiction?
No, it's not. If you have other federal statutes that may conflict, that's more likely to be a part of the theory.
Okay.
If they're in the same code.
My concern is like on the virtue of the plural marriage idea, it's probably a federal statute that prohibited it,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to it being a constitutional thing. I wasn't entirely sure.
Well, if you had a federal statute that prohibited it and a state statute that said you could, the question there is the federal clear statement principle may require you to interpret the federal law narrowly and prevent that granting unless Congress expressly says so. It doesn't work the other way. You can't say that because the federal concerns, the state's interpretation has to be modified to reflect the federal one for federalism. Instead, you would interpret the statute to give meaning to its terms. So that's a long way of saying the constitutional avoidance doctrine typically arises when you have a federal statute that conflicts with the Constitution. You have analogs of it on the state level, where if you have a state statute that conflicts with the state constitution, you have the same principle applying. That's not the same thing as having a statute that conflicts with another federal statute, a different principle. All right, Emily?
If we're only given one statute, can we infer that we don't need to apply like the whole code canon and stuff if we don't have the other statutes in the code to compare them to?
Yes, with the caveat where I say specify any facts that you do not have that might affect your answer. You might want to say a passive. If there are other statutes that directly answer this question, you know, they would go again. Hopefully I'm not giving anyone headaches yet.
Oh no.
All right, well, I'm looking over here and I'm seeing at least. Oh, man. We have probably at least another 18 Kolachis guys, so feel free to keep eating here or take it with you to lunch. Other questions or thoughts? We have a few more minutes before we lose the rent. Okay, well, then again, if you want to talk with me in one-on-one, set up the time. I'm usually here, but I want to make sure I'm here for you. Email us at any time, and I'll just offer it to the deadline. And with that, good luck. Godspeed. I'll see you guys hopefully again. I'll sort of see you at the final. I'll be here for that.
Thank you.
Yeah, I can imagine blacks in reference to marriage in the way it was all like business.